Hello and welcome to this month's Football Fans Podcast, The Shootout. You know how we do by now. We invite a former professional footballer to come on the pod and we dig a little bit deeper into his or her career and kind of just go beyond the surface of their career and talk a little bit about what they're up to right now and try and dig out some of the more significant points of their playing career. And this month on the show, I've got a real bad man. I've got a real G with us. Not to imply that the others weren't real Gs, but we've got a real G on the show this month. We've got the former Fulham, Watford, Bolton, Burnley and many other clubs to name as well. Striker, Mr. Marvin Soldo. Marvin, how you doing, my friend?
I'm good, thanks. You?
I'm good, man. Cheers for coming on the pod, man. I've been trying to get you for a while because I've been reading a lot about you and I've kind of seen you on the circles the last few months and really want to get you on the show. So just for the listeners that don't know, you retired last year.
This year.
Wow, yeah, because even more recent, you retired this year. And you're 28.
Yep.
So for a lot of people, that will be obviously quite surprising. And someone to retire at the age you did. Just initially, tell me a little bit about why you decided to stop playing at the age that you have. Because as far as I'm aware, it wasn't due to a serious injury. Is that correct?
No, it's just the fact that I didn't enjoy being a professional football player anymore, mm-hmm. and felt it was having a severe detrimental effect on my mental health and my well-being. So I decided to do something different, and fortunately for me, I've got other passions that I'm able to just walk straight into.
So you mentioned there that you stopped playing because you just fell out of love with the game. Let's go back a bit. When you started playing football as a young boy and you got signed, how did you feel about football in your late teens and when you initially got signed? Looking back now, was there a period where you think to yourself, I was genuinely in love with playing football? It was all I wanted to do and it gave me the most amount of joy.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, football was my dream. It was my dream to be professional, which I managed to live my dream. And, I that's the thing. What's strange is that I still maintain my love for wanting to play football. Mm. I love the game on that aspect, but I just don't enjoy. I didn't enjoy it being my job. I didn't enjoy the profession. I don't enjoy the industry, and so I made a decision to walk away from that. Mm-hmm.
And how hard was that decision?
For me, it was an easy decision, mm-hmm. because it's something that I'd have thought about for a very, very long time. I knew quite early on in my career, I knew that I wasn't going to play until 35, a lot of players do. I knew that I was going to be somebody who retired fairly early because I just didn't think that, to be honest, I would want to stay so long in the industry.
And was that decision made even when you were enjoying football from the get-go? You always knew from 30 you want to get out.
Yeah, I always knew that from, I maintained that I probably thought I'd retire in my early 30s, mm. to be honest, initially. And that was at the age of 17, 18, 19 even. And that was at the height of my career. Mm.
Wow. And do you remember the moment when you realised, you know what, this is I'm just not enjoying this anymore? Was there a moment, was there a day, was there a game, a training session where you thought to yourself, I'm this isn't fun anymore?
Well, it was more a period really than an actual moment. Mm. But there was the time when I actually said this, I'm making, I'd kind of made my decision over the past year, really. My decision being made, and I was kind of going back and forth. Is it the right time? Do I want to do this? And then I went on loan to Northampton right at the end of my career, actually, and we had a spell of about, we had four games in a row, which we won. And at that point, we were like mid-table and doing okay, but not great. And we won four games on a bounce. And every time I came into the change room, whether I played or I didn't play, all I thought is, I just want to go home. Like, I genuinely don't care that we won. And if we lost, it'd be the same. And that's when I thought, I'm definitely making the right decision, because this isn't how I should feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to love football. You know, I want to continue to love football, because that's something that I maintain that I love football, and I love, you know, since retiring, I probably more so have fallen back in love with playing and watching and just the game in itself, because there isn't any pressures or constraints around me doing so. I can just go, when I'm playing football, I can just go and enjoy it. When I'm watching football, I can just watch it and enjoy it for what it is, as opposed to having to, you know, simply study it. And I, as much as I can, try to ignore a lot of the comments I hear, because, you know, these are things that just bring on negative things, and that have witnessed throughout my career.
What were the responsibilities, or what was the responsibility that whilst being a professional footballer that you didn't enjoy the most?
The responsibility I didn't enjoy the most. To be honest, I think it's not even really a responsibility, but just being so controlled, being in such a controlling environment was for me the thing I didn't like the most. And controlled in every sense of the word, you know, you talk about not just what you wear and you know, having to where you have to be at different times, what you have to eat, and just how you have to act. You know, a lot of the times I felt like I wasn't able to truly be myself, because I was always being told I have to do this way or do this that way, or you can't ask this question, or you have to ask questions like this. And just thought, well, that isn't who I am, so why should I pretend to be somebody else? And why should I, you know, pretend, even in the public, you know, it's something that I think a lot of football players are guilty of, because they haven't got a choice. You know, players and their social medias and the way they portray themselves is just like, it's so false, it's so fabricated, it's so forced, just to get people to, you know, to, not even to get people to like them, it's more so because that's how clubs are telling their players that they need to be and they need to behave.
And so how much of that do you think for you was that a personality trait, and how much of it was that down to football? So if it was another job where you had to wear a certain uniform and you had to, you know, talk a certain way and you had to do certain things, do you think that's a Marvin Saldell thing, that you just don't want to be in any job where you're restricted, or was this particularly unique to the conformity of football?
No, it's more so football. You know, I think I've spoken with a lot of people since I retired from football, you know, a lot of other players at different levels, different stages of their career. Some have retired, some are yet to do so. And, you know, I've had this question because sometimes I think that I have felt that it's only just me that thinks and feels like this. And, you know, I speak to them about how, you know, is it just me that thinks that I'm being controlled, or am I being stubborn in a sense in not wanting to conform? But, you know, so many other players feel like it's the same for them. You know, they're having they're not being allowed to be themselves in personality sense. So some players will get told that they need to be loud and abrasive because that's just who they are. Some people are told they need to go run out and kick people all the time. And some people are, you know, if that's not in your character, then that's not in your character. Some people are being told in the change room they need to be louder, even if that's not in their character. On the pitch, they need to be louder. Some people are being told that in the change room they need to be quieter because they're too lively and managers don't like that. You know, some people might dress a certain way, so they have to change the way they dress every day because they'll be perceived as something, you know, or the manager won't like that, and these things affect your income, you know,
and
only that.
And
you know, I've seen players who also have been told they need to cut their hair because the manager, they're not going to get picked if they don't get their hair.
Oh, really? Is that deep?
Genuinely. I know, off the top of my head, I know two players who've had that experience where they've been told that if they don't cut their hair, then they're not going to get anything.
I hear that. And how many, is it fair to say as a statement that a lot of professional footballers are not happy? Or do you think it's, you know, the majority of footballers, despite the pressures and responsibilities and the element of conformity, the majority of players, you know, love the industry and love the game? Are you extremely rare?
No, I'm not rare at all. I think the majority of players love the game. I would say that the majority of players also hate the industry and what the industry is. And I think, but the thing is people don't look or think outside the game. So it's not, my situation is rare, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So players aren't going to be retiring left, right and centre because players are told from a young age, you need to focus on football. You need to only concentrate on football. So that means they don't think about what they can do outside of the game. And that's another form of control, because when you send someone that they can't think outside or do anything, that may allow them to have some control in, of their life, then you decide when players retire.
Mm.
No, like very rarely the players decide when they retire. The game tells them when that's it.
A lot of people would kind of listen to what you're saying and have read a lot about the articles that have been written about you, and be quite, you know, football's a very lucrative career. You've obviously taken your own life into your own hands and decided that this isn't for me, I'm going to bounce. How difficult is it for a lot of players who are multi-millionaire players? I mean, you played, you know, ball at the top level. So it must be difficult to kind of pull away from all the benefits that come with being a professional footballer. Was that easy in itself? Or was it quite difficult to think, okay, I could do another 5-6 years of this and put up with it and bring the benefits that come with it? Or, no, actually, I'm not happy. Despite all the benefits, I'm going to bounce.
I mean, I was at a level where, you know, I was earning good money, but, you know, the benefits aren't, they didn't outweigh the negatives. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I wasn't at a stage where I was earning, you know, £1 million a year or, you know, 10,000 or whatever it is a week.
Mm.
You know, I wasn't at that stage. So for me, the amount I was earning compared to how I was feeling,
I didn't think
it was worth it. Mm. But like, you know, that I say that, but then if I was earning more, the pressures would be higher. The pressures would be, so I may have felt worse. So it's hard for me to say at this point. You know, it's a very point in time. But to me, at that stage, me walking away was an easy decision, because I thought as well that, you know, I'd spoken to a lot of friends, a lot of family, and you know, many people before I officially announced the decision, and, you know, many people said, you know, you can just get by, like you can just carry on and just kind of just coast by for a couple of years, collect your money and then just leave. And I said, well, this is what I've been doing, this is what I feel like I've been doing already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have given it. This is sorry, my headphones came out.
That's all right.
This is me at the end of the year that you're talking about, or the 2 years you're talking about. I'm there.
I've been doing this, yeah.
I've been doing it, and you know, I've not been my 100% self. I know that I haven't been given enough, I don't think, and you know, carry on doing this. And I don't think that's not fair on me, it's not fair on my friends and family who's not happy, and it's not fair on anybody in football that's, you know, whether it's the people paying me, the people coming to watch, you know, it's not fair on them either, because I'm not going to be giving it my all, because I haven't got it in me to give it my all.
Mm-hmm. How much of a role do you feel social media has played in your unhappiness with the game? Because I'm of the school of thought that the negatives of social media and football severely outweigh the positives and the benefits. Was that part of what made you unhappy as a pro footballer?
I mean, it was definitely. I mean, I don't think I don't think the negatives outweigh the positives, though, in my opinion, because I think there are. I mean, as negative a place social media can be, it has huge benefits for a player as well. Mm-hmm. I think it gives a player a voice, which you absolutely don't get otherwise.
But then doesn't that go back to your earlier point about pretty much every footballer's got a Twitter account, for example, but yeah. How many players can genuinely say what they want to say on Twitter, and how many are managed by management companies or told you can't tweet this, you can't tweet that? So can they really have a voice?
They can have a voice to an extent. I mean, for example, you know, you talk about management company and stuff. Look, take Raheem Sterling for an example. Mm-hmm. You know, the way he is now seen is, you know, a very much a positive role model in this country. Whereas, go back 2 years, mm-hmm. and that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, social media's had a huge role to play in that. Even though everything that's come out is pretty much polished, he still has the opportunity to voice his opinion, various thoughts on a lot of different matters, and that also leads to a lot of other opportunities outside the game. You know, I talk about players looking outside the game, players having freedom. I think that social media plays a massive part in that, because it gives people opportunity to see what players, who players are, and then also what these people, you know, these, again, they're people in the end of the day, but mm-hmm. what these people can do, you know. For me, I had the opportunity to write whilst I was still playing. I had the opportunity to write for 442 magazine, which, if it wasn't for social media, that never would have come about. Mm-hmm. So things like that. I mean, a lot of players have foundations. You know, I had a foundation while I was playing, and a lot of players do some amazing things. And I think there are such huge positives that I would recommend. Definitely every player to have social media, because it's so beneficial for, like, much wider than just the game of football, but then also to just understand that you're going to have a lot of negativity come your way.
You mentioned Raheem Sterling there, and you're another person who has been with us discussions around the one of the biggest ills in football right now, racism in the game. My views are quite radical and not very popular in terms of how to solve the problem of racism within football. If there was one thing that you, if you were in charge of the game, could do to prevent this problem of racism in our sport, what would you do? What needs to be done if we're serious about tackling this problem in our game?
I would take zero tolerance towards racism abuse.
Okay.
That's as simple as that. You know, I'd ban teams, I'd fine teams heavily, you know, whether it's nations or clubs, and then put the onus on them to sort it out mm-hmm. in their domain.
You don't buy the argument that if you punish a nation or a club for the actions of 50, 100, 300 fans, that penalises everybody, and that's not going to be conducive into making, you know, building a more harmonising situation and atmosphere in the ground?
No, because I think that if a club or a nation, whoever, gets punished heavily, they'll do everything within their power to eradicate it and to control things within their territory. You know, if there was violence from fans inside the stadium, the onus would be on that club. It wouldn't be on anybody else. And they would, you know, they would be banned and fined or whatever. You know, for example, if a fan came in, you know, a very cynical hypothetical situation. If a fan came into a stadium with a knife mm-hmm. and ran on the pitch and stabbed the player, who's going to get in trouble most? The club,
yeah.
Who let the fan in? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so why should stance be any different with racism? If you want to eradicate it, you need to be firm enough so that everybody gets in line.
Do you think that do you think this will be ever sorted? Do you think, can you ever see a time in your lifetime where, you know, football will be eradicated? Sorry, racism will be eradicated from football. I don't think racism will ever be eradicated from society, but do you think it's possible to eradicate it from within the football stadium?
It's possible, but I don't think it will.
Because
I don't think the people who are in charge of the game are that concerned about it and take it that seriously to eradicate it. You know, if they wanted to, they would have already done so. You know, match fixing is probably at nil. Advertising, you know, breach of advertisement laws and things like that are, again, pretty much at nil because they were very firm with it. And so, you know, this isn't something that they have to worry about now. And so if you want to implement something and if you want to implement change, you have to be firm. If you want to be firm, then you'll be firm. But if you're saying to somebody, you have 3 opportunities and then we're going to stop the game and then we might stop the game, we might not stop the game, that's not brief. That's not firm.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you give people 3 opportunities to do something, they're going to probably just keep doing it until the third time when, you know, you're going to say, okay, we stop now. And then they'll just come back and do it the next time.
I actually personally agree with you. I think zero tolerance. I would fine clubs £10 million. I would kick him out of competitions. I'd kick him. I'd deduct points. I totally agree. I'd even go one step further. I think that the black community, be it players, fans, media, I think it's unfair. But I think we have to take responsibility for this by not buying our subscriptions with Sky and BT, by walking off pitches. I think we have to take ownership of this situation because it's quite clear the governing bodies, most of whom are run by white men, are not going to. So if they're not going to do it and we're going to participate in this industry and this sport, then we've got to take control because they don't care about our welfare, or safety and our well-being. So I think we have to take control of this issue ourselves. That's very unfair because this is not our problem. But I think that if we wait for them to fix it, I just can't see anything being done anytime soon, if at all. I just want to rattle through a few more things. And we will talk a little bit of football, I promise, in a bit. And I know you've got to go. Money management. A lot of players we hear about when they finish, when they retire, they go broke, they go bankrupt, and they fall into severe debt. A lot of people, we talk on my podcast a lot about the responsibilities from clubs to assist these young boys who are coming into ridiculous sums of money at a very young and vulnerable age. Where do you feel the responsibility, the balance of responsibility lies in ensuring that these young boys coming into the game and being thrown massive financial contracts are secure and set up? Because a lot of people, like I say, think that clubs should be doing more to support these young boys in acquiring this money. I don't personally agree, but I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on young boys earning huge sums of money and how they manage that.
I mean, the onus isn't necessarily on the clubs themselves, but I think the players' union should be more present in that space, really, and they should be the ones leading players to understand how to handle finances, how to put money away, how to think about the future. But I think if that onus comes from the PFA and in terms of the union, then the clubs kind of fall in line and kind of do the little bits they need to do to help, because obviously players move from club to club, so you're not going to have a player at one club in an investment scheme that's tied up or whatever, and then they're moving club and then they have to contact their old club to sort things out or whatever. Do you know what I mean? That's going to be a very difficult, messy situation, but I think the PFA should have something that is in place for all players and it's just something that remains, you know, whether it should be something that players learn from when they're right in the academy and are just educated about it consistently as they progress throughout their career, because it's so important, like, to be able to sustain a future beyond the game. And it's not just about finance, it's about education and being more well-rounded as a human being, really, when you're ready to leave the game and go to the real world.
What was your experience, Marvin, with money and the PFA in particular? Was you always good with money? Did you have to go through, you know, lose a lot of money to learn lessons? Did you have someone helping you? What was your experience when you first came into to money and you got your first big contract?
I spent a bit of money, but the big chunks of my money went into property, and that was because, you know, my mum at home was pushing me into, like, getting property, because having a house and somewhere you can always live and settle is obviously an important thing. And then obviously, you know, investment property in terms of, you know, you're getting rental income is another revenue stream. So that's, for me, that's what I did. But, you know, not every player is fortunate enough to have people around them that are clued up or giving them the right advice or actually want to actually help them save money, because a lot of the time players have people around that just want to spend their money as opposed to actually help them save it.
Phil Foden, a guy that a lot of people talk really highly of. He's not getting big minutes at Manchester City. Where do you stand on the whole best way to develop? Do you think you have to be playing in some form of high level to really develop and improve? Or do you think that he is better off staying where he is, getting less minutes on the pitch than he would at, say, a Bournemouth or a Wolves or wherever, but learning under the tutelage of Guardiola and David Silva and Bernardo Silva? What's the best way of developing under a great coach or under a lesser good coach, but actually playing and getting minutes?
I think in his situation, I would, you know, see, he's not going to heed my advice, but I'd highly recommend that he would stay and learn, because, you know, he'd be understanding. Obviously, he's playing with some of the best players in the world, training with them on a day-to-day basis. He's understanding the game. I mean, I think one of the things that players don't get enough of is watching football to understand and to learn. Whereas he's watching the best players, you know, week in, week out, as well as tactically understanding where he needs to be, where they need to be. And as well as having, you know, in my opinion, the best manager and coach in the world, every single day he's improving. And the biggest thing is the fact that he's only a kid. He's still, what, 18?
Mm-hmm.
He's a teenager, you know. I made my first team debut at 18. You know, 18 is very, very young.
But so is it though? In this day and age, is 18 good or 19? Is that you think that's still young?
It still is very young. You know, you're physically, he's going to be nowhere near where he's going to be. Technically, he's still going to improve. So he's still very, very young. He doesn't need to play 30 games a season to develop. He's still developing. He's still developing at an extraordinary rate because he's playing with the best players. You know, if he played under, you know, if he went to a club that was in a relegation battle, he might play 30 games in the Premier League. He might get kicked about a bit. He probably won't touch the ball much. Tactically, he might not get as much, you know, knowledge, because the coach might not be as good, the manager might not be as good, technically might not be improving as much because he's not actually playing with the ball. So he may have played 30 more games, but would he have improved as much? Who knows? He might do, but he might not. I think everybody's in a rush almost all the time. You know, as I said, he's only a kid. So he's going to play. He's going to play for Man City. He's going to play a lot of games for Man City. But there's no need for him to be impatient and think, yeah, I need to do it right now. I need to get out, because, you know, someone might get injured and he might have a run of games. He might come out for a run of games. You know what I mean? So the opportunity is there for him. Clearly, the opportunity is there for him in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I think he just needs to just... You know, he can keep improving and be patient and keep improving whilst he's there with, you know, playing with the best players, training with the best players, and learning and understanding the game even better every day.
One more question before I kind of ask you a few football-y ones, and I will let you go, I promise. I've deliberately not spoken too much about the issue of mental health in football because you've done so many interviews and there's so much work online that people can read and hear you on podcasts where you speak really well and really openly and honestly about mental health and being in football. But just briefly, I know you've done or you're still doing a lot of work with the organisation Calm. Tell us a little bit about the work you're doing with them. And also, you know, how with the strains of being a modern day footballer and how that interlinks with functioning as a human being still as well, and how difficult that can be.
I mean, Calm are great. You know, I don't actually do too much. You know, I just help out with bits and bobs where I can and kind of throw ideas at them for different campaign ideas, etc. As a football player, the mental strain that you can be under can be, you know, extreme for a lot of players. You know, for me, it was, you know, for a long time. And I think that's just surely the pressures that you find yourself under, you place yourself under to perform, because performing is the way you put food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the game of football, life can change very, very quickly, very drastically. You know, you could be on, you know, players can be on earning £10,000 a week, and then within 6 months they can be earning £1,000 a week because a lot of different things may happen, and all of a sudden their whole life is turned around. So it can be very difficult, and especially when you're always looking over your shoulder for other players who may be coming in or out or whatever, but then also you're looking beyond as well.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking into the future. What am I going to do? You know, a lot of players, if you ask them what you're going to do when you finish, most, you know, the large majority will say, I don't know. And that's not I don't know, as in I'm, you know, I've got a couple of options. I have no idea. And that's a huge weight to place upon anybody's shoulders.
When
you're in an industry that tells you to not think about anything beyond that industry itself, but then when the day comes, you're going to be earning no money and probably have family and you know, bills to pay, mortgage, and expect to just do something else.
I'm an Arsenal fan, and we've spoken on this show a lot about the Granit Xhaka situation regarding him being booed off the pitch a few weeks ago by his own fans, and in reacting the way he reacted, he's been subsequently stripped of the captaincy. How big an issue of mental health do you think that is for him, being a professional footballer, not playing very well, being in bad form, and being booed off of the pitch by your own supporters? You know, and the abuse online he got was even worse, and then stripped to the captaincy. Is that an example of the pressures of being a professional footballer and where someone's mental health can really, really come to the fore?
Yeah, massively. I think, you know, his situation was, you know, really extreme on as well, because...
And do we forget about that as football fans, that he might be playing poor, maybe he's not good enough, but the kind of abuse that footballers get, we forget that these are humans that have to perform on a stadium of 60,000 people. They have the pressures, as you say, of providing for their family. These aren't bad people trying to play poorly. These are human beings that either aren't good enough or just in bad form, but we forget that. And that the detriment of that is their mental health.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, the biggest thing is that people forget that nobody wants to play badly. Nobody goes out and says, I'm going to play badly today on purpose. You know, everybody's trying. Everybody wants to do well. Everybody wants to win. But everybody facing wants to win too. And preparations may differ. The craziest thing is you never know what situation somebody's going through. You know, I played in situations where, you know, I played in games where I've, you know, I for 3 years I had a broken foot. And I played and was playing games for 3 years on a broken foot, and it was progressively getting worse. I also had a game where I played where I was in the hospital until about 5 a.m. because my daughter was ill. So I hadn't slept. And then we got on the coach to an away game for a 3 o'clock kickoff. And I didn't particularly have a great game. But then I just thought, well, if that situation happened to me where I was booed, you know, I'd probably come out and say, this is what happened. And people might understand, but then I shouldn't have to explain that. Because I'm trying. You know, every player goes out on the pitch to try and they want to win and they want to do well, but that doesn't happen every game. You know, no player plays well every single game. It's impossible. So, you know, I think understanding where football is at. Football is at a very strange place where players are almost seen as like objects and robots almost. You know, because the vast sums of money in football, people think that money cures all problems. But that money brings a lot of problems as well. So I think it's just about getting a grasp of reality, really, in the sense of that these people are human beings who just have a job, have a life, have work, and they go to work and they try to perform. And so many different circumstances contribute to how they perform. And they may perform good, they may perform bad, but in the end of the day, they're trying to perform well. And they still go home to their families, to their kids, and still want to live their lives.
I'm going to rattle through a few final ones. Favourite goal? What was your favourite goal you ever scored, Marvin?
I scored a goal for England under 21s, my first actually, for the 21s against Israel, which was a really good goal.
Talk us for it.
Left foot. I think it was Alex Chamberlain passed me the ball, and I had my back to goal, but I kind of chopped it to the side and like kind of turned as well at the same time and then just smashed it in my left foot. And it was from about 30 yards and went in off the post.
A real banger. Favourite manager you played under?
Probably Sean Dyche, I'd say, for longevity as well, because I had him as a manager at many different levels.
I've got Sean Dyche here because he signed you, is it at Burnley?
Yeah.
And he, despite signing you, he didn't play you a lot, but yet you've still spoken, I've read in red quotes, really warmly and really positively about him. What was it about Sean Dyche that you enjoyed working under so much?
Well, he was my youth team manager at Watford and my first team manager at Watford as well. So I spent a lot of time with him and he, you know, understood me and you know, helped me develop in football and as a professional football player, because I think he helped me kind of cross that line in the sense of understanding the industry a bit better and kind of learning to adapt to the industry.
Biggest myth about football from being in the inside?
That all players earn 100 grand a week.
People lie about their wages, or the reports about them are lies, yeah?
Yeah, the reports about wages are just incredible.
Why? Why do the media lie? Why do the clubs lie? Why does anybody lie about?
Clubs don't lie. It's just, nobody's lying. It's just people just, sometimes it's agents that put these things, you know, to play the wages into the papers because they want their players to seem like they get more because then they're worth more, and then
the next place they'll get more
money. You know, players. I see some players' wages in the paper or wherever it is, and it'll say XYZ on 90 grand a week, and then somewhere else will say 130, somewhere else will say 160, and some will say to me, oh, he's on 160 grand a week. I say, he's not. He might be on 80, which is obviously still a lot of money, but we're talking about right at the top here.
Yeah, yeah.
I say he might be on 80, and he might be on 60, but then you'll have all these bonuses that will make his contract by year four of his 5-year contract that he might be on 160, but not definitely. You know, it'd be appearances, it'll be, you know, appearance fees will add up to that. Loyalty bonus maybe, or, you know, winning a competition, certain amount of goals, certain amount of appearances, and then your your wage, your basic wage would increase. There's so many different stipulations that go into a contract bonus wise that people just, you know, I think some people just add it all up and just say, oh yeah, that player's on XYZ. And I think players don't realise that, I mean, sorry, people don't realise that clubs haven't got as much money. A lot of clubs haven't got as much money as people think, especially in the lower leagues. You know, some of the figures that I've seen fans throw around, I'm like, I wish you knew, and I wish you realised that these players are not earning anywhere near that. I'm not anywhere near that.
Interesting. Hardest opponent you came up against?
As a defender, Thiago Silva.
What was it about him that was so hard to
he just
to beat?
He was faster than me, stronger than me, and read the game better than me. So I pretty much couldn't do anything.
At what level did you come up against him?
We played Brazil in a friendly before the Olympics.
I see.
The Team GB.
Okay. Who's your current favourite striker in world football, and who's your favourite striker of all time?
Favourite? Messi's not really a striker, but I still want to say Messi.
Okay. All right. And of all time?
Thierry Henry.
No explanation there needed. Just two more. You've transitioned from football into the world of media. How are you finding that? And how far back was the planning in deciding what you wanted to do once you left the game?
I'm really enjoying it on this side of things, and having retired and being able to have a lot of creative freedom in a sense as well. How far back? I mean, I didn't actually even plan for this to be my career or, you know, path really. It just kind of happened. You know, I started writing a long time ago and started making short films with two friends a couple of years ago. And with those two friends, started a production company, and things have just continued in this, you know, and gone on since really. And I'm still writing, you know, I've written columns for 442, as I said earlier, for The Guardian. I'm currently writing a screenplay for a short film. You know, I still write poetry here and there. But then on the production side of things, you know, being able to create concepts for different ideas, whether it's adverts or documentaries or series or whatever it may be, I just love being able to create and telling stories is something that I'm massively passionate about. So I'm very lucky that I've found something that I am passionate about, because it's not always the case with a lot of people.
When you said earlier on at the start that you're enjoying watching football a lot more now, now that you're out of the game and you're not under the pressure and responsibilities you once were, what is it about football that you enjoy again, and how do you look on football now, knowing what you know from the inside on the outside?
Sorry, what was the question? I'm sorry.
Just as now as an outsider of the dressing room, of the industry, sorry, not industry, of the sport itself, how do you view watching football now? Because you mentioned that you enjoy it a lot more now watching it. What is it about watching football that you enjoy a lot more now, and that you've managed to get your love back for the game? What are the things now that you get you excited about football as an outsider?
I've always loved football. I probably watch more games now than when I was playing, because I think there's a lot of exciting teams, a lot of exciting football being played, great players, and just being able to watch it from, you know, even though I'm an Arsenal fan, I watch most games in the perspective of a neutral who just wants to watch a good game of football, really. And so, you know, I've been able to do that, and I just enjoy it. I enjoy the passion and you know, people's love and how happy it makes people, and the game itself being played. And I think nowadays it's played a lot better than it has been in the past, where people are playing football more attractive, me, I'd say.
I forgot to mention at the start of the interview that you did represent GB at the Olympics in 2012, so I need to put some respect on your name properly there. Final question I asked to all my guests on this show, Marvin. If there was one thing you could do to change or improve football, you're the football god, you have the wand. If there was one thing you could do to change or improve the game, what would it be?
I think I don't know. I think to make it more fun, though, I'd probably add more cup competitions and smaller leagues.
Okay, more tournaments and
not many more, just a couple, just like one or two more, because everyone likes cups.
Okay, and make the league season shorter.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a new one. It's a new one. I like that one. Marvin, I've taken the piss. I said to you we'd be half an hour. We've been an hour. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for coming on the pod. Thank you very much also for a lot of the work you've been doing. I mentioned earlier on around mental health. And I've always found you very, very intelligent and eloquent and very progressive in a lot of your views and opinions, and very honest as well. So thanks for coming on the pod. I wish you all the best going forward. I'm glad you're enjoying, you've gone back to loving the game again. That makes me really, really happy as well. Thanks for your time, boss. I'll speak to you very soon. Cheers for coming on.
Much appreciated.
Cheers, man. If you enjoyed that interview, don't forget to subscribe, leave a comment, leave any feedback, any questions you may have for us here on the FFP. We're across all the socials, Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. And also subscribe to us on iTunes and Spotify as well. Till next week. Peace.